And next, muses and metaphor. All this month, we've been hearing your poetic tweets on this program. It's part of our celebration of National Poetry Month. These are poems of no more than 140 characters sent through Twitter. They've been coming in from everywhere, from Atlanta, Georgia, from Dallas, Texas, from Palo Alto, California. Today, a tweet from Brent Beatty, a fifth-generation Vermonter who still lives in the house he was born in within the small southern Vermont town of Whitingham. Brent Beatty is a founder of Landmark College that's designed for students with learning disabilities, and there he serves as executive vice president and provost. Now remember, these are short, only 140 characters each, so listen up.
This is Brent Beatty, and this is my tweet, Elegy for Brian. Your soul bulleting into the sky, the rifle's sharp report, a blue heron I saw flying at night outlined against a quicksilver moon.
Now remember, these are tweets and they are short, so we're going to play it again.
Your soul bulleting into the sky. The rifle's sharp report. A blue heron I saw flying at night outlined against a quicksilver moon.
That's a poetic tweet by Brent Beatty. If you'd like to listen to some of our previous tweets, you can do so by going to the Tell Me More website. Go to npr.org and click on the programs menu to find Tell Me More. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, paparazzi may be a common sight in New York or L.A., but Washington, D.C.? In our weekly look inside the pages of the Washington Post magazine, we'll find out why the paparazzi are coming to the nation's capital. In fact, they're already here. But first, we want to tell you why today, on World Malaria Day, leaders of a hospital in Rwanda, among others around the world, are celebrating. World Malaria Day was started by the World Health Organization to recognize progress made in controlling the disease around the world. And progress has been made. International donors poured an estimated $1.8 billion just last year into fighting malaria and similar amounts in recent years. The investment is paying off. In the past 10 years, 11 countries in Africa have seen the number of new malaria cases and deaths drop by more than 50%, that according to the World Health Organization. But now, as the U.S. and other donors struggle with their own budgetary concerns, health experts worry that the headway made in controlling malaria might be threatened. For more on this, we've called on Dr. Joya Mukherjee. She is the Chief Medical Officer of Partners in Health. That's an international health organization with projects in Rwanda, Haiti, Peru, Mexico, and eight other countries. She's a doctor who specializes in infectious disease, and she's also an associate professor of global health at Harvard Medical School, and we reached her on the line from Boston. Dr. Mukherjee, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, happy World Malaria Day to you.
Thank you very much. We're happy to have some progress on this day.
You know, we wanted to get a sense of the efforts to control malaria in one place. So we spoke earlier with Dr. Peter Droback. He's the director of Partner in Health's project in Rwanda. He's a friend of yours. He directs 37 health centers and three rural hospitals around the country. And this is what he had to say.
The Rwandan Ministry of Health just did a fairly rigorous analysis of the progress so far in malaria control. And the findings thus far show a 70% reduction in the overall number of malaria cases over the last several years and a 61% reduction in malaria deaths.
So I wanted to ask if this success is typical and what do you think are the major factors contributing to it?
Yeah, I think the success in Rwanda is never typical because Rwanda has an enormous amount of political will and the ability to really have policy change at the national level be translated down at the health center level throughout the country. And we're happy to be partners with the government of Rwanda. But even in places we are not partners with them, they have profound effects. So Rwanda is less typical. However, we are seeing drops throughout the world, as you mentioned in the introduction. And I think it's very encouraging. The thing is, we've long known what to do to prevent and treat malaria. And we have had a lack of finances globally to bring to bear on the problem. And so left to the devices of the market, the people who are most vulnerable to malaria, poor children, are really ill-equipped to just pay for bed nets or medicines on, you know, on if the burden is placed on poor families.
Well, one of the things that activists have long told us, which is that one of the key prevention efforts, bed nets, are actually quite inexpensive. But what about the treatments?
So bed nets are very inexpensive, and yet before I go to treatment, I would say that what we found and some interesting work was done at the Poverty Action Lab here in Boston, showing that any fee for a net for a poor family results in no net being used. So regardless of how cheap they are, we have to make them free, and we have to help people to install them in their homes. The treatments, the prices have come down, and some of this has been due to generics coming on the market. Some of them have been due to philanthropic efforts of companies like Novartis to make drugs such as artemisinin-based compounds much, much cheaper for poor governments to afford. So we see a lot of forces, more money to the problem, some corporate responsibility, some generic competition, and political will on the parts of governments to really bring these treatments to the people who need them most.
Now, I want to ask you, though, that it's no secret that this country is facing, you know, budgetary issues, certainly around the deficit. There's been some very heated discussion around how the U.S. spends its money and what its priorities should be. So, and foreign aid is one of those areas that often does not have a very vocal constituency. So I'd like to ask you, what would you say to someone who asks why malaria should be a funding priority at this point when the U.S., certainly among other donor nations, is struggling with its own issues?
Well, first of all, obviously I'm a very big supporter of U.S. foreign assistance as a way of promoting peace and stability around the world. And I think as we look at our military spending, and some have just recently, even from the military itself, we see that this kind of force that we're using is not really winning hearts and minds around the world. The treatment of malaria, on the other hand, is highly effective. Prevention is highly effective and relatively inexpensive. And malaria remains one of the biggest killers of children under five around the world. So this is a way that the American people, in concert with governments, can do something very positive that will have a profound effect, even in a short term, in less than a year, one malaria season, and can really generate life-saving therapy, as well as really, you know, a way to express our solidarity and concern for children all over the world. So I think this is a really great investment in the lives of poor children, and not only in the lives, but the intellectual and social achievement of these children. We know that profound anemia, which is caused by multiple bouts of malaria, is one of the main things that prevents children from reaching their social potential. So you can stop that by treating malaria.
Dr. Mukherjee, we just have 1 minute left, so I wanted to ask you, international leaders, including the U.N. Special Envoy for Malaria and President Obama, have expressed the goal to stop all deaths from malaria by 2015. Is that realistic?
Yes, absolutely. I love ambitious goals, and we should do it.
You think we will?
Sure, absolutely. If we have the will and we have the money, and the will is there by the countries that want to stop this problem, stop seeing children die needlessly. So we need the money. We have plans. It's not a difficult thing to do. We can do it.
Dr. Joya Mukherjee is Chief Medical Officer of Partners in Health. That's an international health organization with projects in Rwanda, which we've been hearing about, Haiti, Peru, Malawi, and eight other countries. She has worked in international health for more than 20 years, and she was kind enough to join us on the line from Boston. Dr. Mukherjee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, and thanks for having this program.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. In today's down market, realtors are trying whatever they can to sell homes. They're using social media, spending hours staging homes. And as Caitlin Kenny of our Planet Money team reports, they're even trying to move properties by capitalizing on our national obsession with celebrity.
Here's something you don't expect to hear when a realtor is showing you a property they want you to buy.
This is where Dog Day Afternoon was filmed. To me, when you walk in, you can almost picture, like, this unit to me seems like this would be the vault where the money is.
This is realtor Celeste Moses of Prospective Properties. And the movie she's talking about is a 1975 film starring Al Pacino. It's about a gay man who robs a bank to pay for his partner's sex change. And, well, it doesn't go so smoothly. Here's a scene most people remember.
Get over there, will ya?
He wants to kill me so bad he can taste it.
I got always going to kill
him. Erica! Erica! Will ya? Erica!
Dog Day Afternoon is not a feel-good movie. It's dark and it's gritty. But that hasn't stopped Celeste from highlighting the film as she tries to sell this Brooklyn apartment. The opening line of her online ad is, "Be a part of Hollywood history." And in the section of the ad with all the photographs, you see the typical shots of the mantle and the kitchen, but there's also a photo of a man standing in front of a bank with policemen pointing guns at him.
It's kind of scary, but it's Al Pacino. It's not as if it's a strange person. And you look at it, you go, who the heck is that? And you go, oh, it's Al Pacino. What's this about? It's an attention getter.
The celebrity link to real estate gets out one way or another. If realtors don't promote it, the media does. Recently, in the Murray Hill neighborhood of New York City, an apartment in a building once owned by Bob Dylan sold for $842,000. New York Magazine featured the apartment in their Fame Slept Here section. But here's the strange part. The person who bought it couldn't have cared less about the Bob Dylan connection. In fact, he's in the middle of a gut renovation. And that raises the question, does the celebrity sales strategy work? To find out, I called out to the capital of celebrity real estate, Los Angeles. Broker Gary Gold has been selling homes in the area for the last 30 years. He's currently an executive vice president at Hilton, yes, that Hilton, and Highland Real Estate. Gold says just because a celebrity lived in a home or a movie was filmed there doesn't mean you can automatically jack up the price 10 or 20%. But the celebrity aura isn't worthless.
I currently have Ashton Kutcher's house for sale. And we did get a lot of exposure. And I probably had at least twice as many showings that I would have normally had. So if you get more exposure and more potential buyers see the property, you have a better opportunity to get more money.
Bottom line, a property associated with celebrity will attract more interest. And the more people that see that property, the better the chance of a bidding war. As for Celeste with the Dog Day Afternoon condo, she's got some new competition. A similar unit in the building recently went on sale for almost exactly the same price, although that listing makes no mention of Hollywood history or Al Pacino. Caitlin Kenney, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at libank.com.
Some of the nation's richest and most important ecosystems lie where the ocean meets the land. Those same coastal areas will disappear if the sea level continues rising as a result of climate change. Now, scientists and managers at a wildlife refuge in North Carolina are attempting to fight back the sea. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge encompasses 154,000 acres of marshland and a rare type of lowland forest called Pocosin. It's just about the only place on Earth where the endangered red wolf still roams, and a lot of it is at or near sea level, which means it's in big trouble as the sea rises. But with the unbounded optimism of youth, a dozen or so college students arrived one spring day to see what they could do. Jamie Rowan from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro is raking oyster shells into mesh bags, which will be used to build a reef off a nearby coastline. This music major, studying classical guitar, likes the change of pace.
My teacher told me to rest my hands this week. That's definitely not happening.
Yeah, really.
His classmate, Elizabeth Livingston, happily labors nearby on her spring break.
I feel like you'll remember this over, partying at the beach or something.
The bags they're filling and then stacking on wooden pallets are enough to build just a few hundred feet of reef to slow erosion along a coastline that stretches hundreds of miles. So you might ask whether these students are tilting at windmills. After all, the sea has been encroaching here for decades. Just ask Winky Silver. His family home on the nearby Outer Banks has been moved 6 times. And as he watches the students raking shells, he tells a story he heard from another of the old-timers around here.
He said his grandmother could walk from Roanoke Island to the Dare County mainland by rail, which meant not a railroad train, but a rail fence post that she would put from clump to clump and go and cross over. Whether that's rocking chair history or geographic history, I don't know. But I do know that that was, if you look back at the old maps, that was a marsh all the way across.
Silver knows that the pond pines that are characteristic of the Pocosin coastal forest are also losing ground to the ocean.
The stumps out there in the shallow water, you can tell, you know, if you bring a boat in there and tear your boat up, you know that once that was tree line and land.
Silver wears a homemade visor to keep the sun off his ears. He's been hired to use his barges to build the reef out of these bags of shells. And though the work has been taking place on a federal wildlife refuge, the effort is actually being led by a scientist from the Nature Conservancy, Brian Booten.
See you later, Wakey.
Booten starts out in his pickup truck toward Point Peter, where the reef is being built. On the way, he explains that the reef is just one part of a larger plan to preserve the refuge. We pull over along the side of a gravel road to see another element of the plan. The eager young biologist slips on his rubber boots and heads off into a wide expanse of marsh. Water comes up the sides of our shoes. You can't get any closer to sea level than this. About 100 yards off the road, he proudly points to a bare twig coming out of the sodden soil. It's a freshly planted cypress tree.
Here's one of our cypress. Right now, not quite leafed out.
Like the college students, this twig of a tree also seems to radiate hopefulness.
Once these leaf out this spring here, we'll have a nice lime green veneer across the top of all this marsh grass out here. So it'll be pretty evident how many cypress are in this area.
The experiment is designed to see whether the 20,000 very tolerant trees they've planted can help create a forest here, which is home to the red wolf, black bear, bobcats, and other animals whose habitat is gradually disappearing. Of course, if the sea keeps rising, these trees could simply find themselves drowned in salt water. Booten has been thinking about that a lot. Soon after we return to the road, we come across a refuge construction crew installing a new culvert. And surprisingly, the goal of this project is to bring more water into the marsh where the trees are growing. Booten explains that the hope is this fresh water will build up organic soil here by encouraging the plants that produce it.
Part of the soil conditions that those species need to really be happy and healthy is to have a damp soil.
So you want to bring the water onto the landscape. That it seems counterintuitive if you're trying to stave off sea level rise.
Well, not if you're a wetland and you need to be wet.
So how quickly can these soils build up?
Well, they're not very fast. You're looking at a couple of millimeters a year.
Unfortunately, sea level is rising at the rate of 3 or 4 millimeters a year here, and forecast to rise faster.
We're not quite keeping up with sea level rise, and I think that's going to be something that is the case pretty much everywhere that we work with in Pamlico Sound. But the idea is to reduce the rate of loss.
Losing the battle, but losing it slowly, makes perfect sense to Mike Bryant. He runs this refuge for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
We expect change from sea level rise as a consequence of the warming and the melting of ice. And as that sea level rises, we expect to lose land.
When you look down the road, is this refuge doomed?
I don't know if it's doomed, but I certainly think it's shrinking.
Eventually, the maps of this area show this refuge will be almost entirely submerged once sea level rises 4 feet, which could be within a lifetime. But he says simply that change is inevitable on planet Earth. So what he can do is help the ecosystems adapt with some grace.
I don't think we can put a dike around a 150,000-acre refuge and pump it out. So I think we just have to adapt that landscape to the change.
That means fighting back the tide in the short run, but it also means thinking ahead.
We'd like to think about where is the next best place for wildlife on higher ground. How do we have wildlife corridors between Alligator River Refuge and those lands? And then how do we secure some of those lands that are on higher ground for wildlife in the future?
While Bryant starts the delicate task of acquiring new land, Booten is trying to buy time. When we arrive at Point Peter, a gale is blowing up between us and the Outer Banks off to the east. These churning whitecaps are eating away parts of Point Peter at the rate of up to 30 feet a year, he says. But then he points to some white pipes sticking out of the water to our left. That's where Winky Silver has been stacking those bags of oyster shells out in the water. And Booten says the marsh behind that reef is eroding at a much slower rate. But he knows he can't protect very much of this coast with labor-intensive reefs.
We are focusing on finding those areas that are most vulnerable right now and that are most in need of having their shoreline erosion addressed.
It's not a permanent solution, but in the process they are learning what works and what doesn't work in their struggle to fight back the sea. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And now we open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine, something we do just about every week to find interesting stories about the way we live now. And the way some people live now is amid exploding flashbulbs, the rapid-fire click of cameras. Now, you'd figure you'd see mobs of photographers surrounding celebrities on the streets of Manhattan or Hollywood, at least the streets where celebrities hang out. But paparazzi in Washington, D.C., it turns out that paparazzi are becoming a fact of life in D.C., at trendy restaurants, and in front of key venues, like this recent appearance by Charlie Sheen.
Charlie, how you doing, brother? Hey, Charlie.
Can I get some room, please?
Hey, Charlie.
Get some room. Back.
Hey, Charlie, is D.C. winning?
In a piece titled In Your Face, Washington Post staff writer Annie Gowan says that the paparazzi are winning in D.C. of all places. And she joins us now from the studios at the Washington Post to tell us more about it. Annie, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, when you think Washington, D.C., and you think photography, I think you probably think, you know, shots of the Lincoln Memorial. I don't think people think of like shoving, sweating, you know, hordes of people trying to get shots of celebrities. So when did this all happen?
Well, a lot of the society photographers or the event photographers kind of date it to maybe 2 or 3 years ago. It's really the advent of, you know, sort of the globalization of the media. And the other part of it is that Washington is a lot more hip than it used to be. You know, there's a sexy young administration. There's a lot more celebrities are coming to town, as they will be this weekend for the White House Correspondents' Dinner, to walk the red carpet and also to advocate on the Hill. So it's kind of a dual thing that's going on, which explains sort of this outcropping of these new photographers.
You follow one paparazzo in particular, a man named Colin Drummond, and you talk about how he got his big break. Would you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, Colin is kind of an interesting guy. You know, he had a past. He was convicted on drug charges when he was during the 90s. But then later on in life, he shaped up and became a news photographer. But he started branching out into the celebrity realm in D.C. And in 2007, he covered the Howard University commencement where Oprah Winfrey was speaking. And he managed to get a few shots of her. And it wasn't until later on that he noticed that one of the shots sort of appeared, she was wearing flip-flop sandals, and it appeared that she had a sixth toe. And when he sent that up to his agency in New York, it just went viral on the web. And he made, I think, $40,000, and he still gets residuals from this wacky picture. And actually, Oprah doesn't really have a sixth toe. But nevertheless, the six-toed Oprah was a big moneymaker for Colin Drummond, who's really kind of the godfather of the D.C. paparazzi scene.
How does he figure out where these people are going to be so they can get these kinds of shots?
Right. So they have these guys, and there's only about a half a dozen of them. It's not like it is in L.A. yet, but they have a wide network of tipsters. So they have, you know, limo drivers that tell them stuff and hotel doormen and the concierges. And so that's kind of how they get their information.
And when you say tip them off, I assume it's a two-way, the tipping is a two-way street. Presumably they're not just giving them this information out of the kindness of their hearts. They pay for it, right?
Right. I don't know how much Colin would pay for it, but he definitely, you know, gives out sports tickets and other kind of tokens of his esteem to his tipsters. But, you know, when we were following him, it was kind of a challenge because his day is, you know, he never knows where, you know, what he's going to hear from day to day. And at one point, you know, we were all set to to follow him to Capitol Hill, and he got a tip that Jennifer Hudson, who's really hot right now, as you know, because of her new album and her weight loss, was coming into Dulles Airport. So he had to race off to Dulles Airport to get her, and he did, coming off the plane from Paris.
I think it is known that celebrities don't love this. They don't love, you know, going out to get a cup of coffee and having people in their flip-flops and having right. people following them. And that they're in certain cities, I think people get used to it even though they don't love it. Have there been any incidents in Washington, D.C. where a celebrity has just said, you know what, no, and reacted, you know, in a negative way? There's a couple interesting ones.
Yeah. I mean, the famous one is when Shia LaBeouf was here filming Transformers last year, and there was a paparazzo named Mark Wilkins who was filming him, and he got angry and threw a cup of coffee at him and sort of walked away. And that was a famous incident. And then when that happened, that was kind of when people sort of started waking up around here to think, oh, we really do have paparazzis in Washington, D.C. But then another famous incident was when Colin Drummond, who we talked about earlier, and another paparazzo were chasing Russell Crowe, who was in town filming Body of Lies, and they were chasing him up the Clara Barton Parkway, which is a road that runs along the Potomac. And everybody knows that Russell Crowe doesn't like photographers. So he at one point just hopped out of his car, and they had some mountain bikes in the back of the car, and he jumped on his mountain bike and rode up the bike path to get away from them.
Well, there you go. That's one way to do it.
Yeah.
But before we let you go, you mentioned, you know, paparazzi chasing people. You know, that has a very checkered history. As you know, on the one hand, so you've got two competing things here in Washington, D.C. On the one hand, you've got there is a tradition of free speech here. There is a tradition of people being able to film and record and photograph, you know, in public places. On the other hand, you know, Princess Diana, you know, obviously the crash that killed her had many factors, including excessive speed and so forth. But there are those who say, well, part of the reason that they were driving so fast was to get away from the photographers. And I wondered mm-hmm. if there's any discussion in this city about, you know, regulating this conduct because of those concerns that sometimes it gets out of hand that, you know, people sometimes do get hurt in the fray.
At this point, it seems the only concerns that have legitimately been raised is it sort of out of place in the capital city? Is it too indecorous for this town? I think when it happened at the Kennedy Center Honors, which is another big event here, you know, people were kind of shocked by the shouting and the pushing and the shoving. But, you know, we spoke to Terry Gaynor, who's the Capitol Hill police chief, and he's now the sergeant at arms. But anyway, he was saying that, you know, it's really a small group at this point, and there's so much more infrastructure for security in place here than there are in other towns, just especially after 9/11. So it's not a big concern at this point.
Annie Gowan is a staff writer for The Washington Post. Her piece this week is called In Your Face. And if you'd like to read it in its entirety, and we hope you will, you can find a link to it on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. Annie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
New research sheds light on a tough call aviation officials had to make last April when a volcano erupted in Iceland. Wind blew a cloud of volcanic ash toward Europe, and ash particles can be hazardous to jet aircraft. Authorities had to decide whether to ground planes and inconvenience tens of thousands of travelers or let the planes fly and risk an accident. They decided to ground the planes, and as NPR's Joe Palco reports, it now appears that was a good call.
The Icelandic eruption was a pain in the neck for a lot of people. One of them was Susan Stipp. She's a professor of nanotechnology at the University of Copenhagen. She had colleagues that needed to get home to Denmark and others who were waiting to leave.
And I had some samples that needed to come from Scotland and get processed in Denmark.
Stipp wondered if officials had made the right decision to close the airspace over Europe. And since she studies tiny particles like the ones in volcanic ash, she was in a position to find out.
So I phoned up my friend and colleague, Siggi Gislason, in Iceland. And we agreed to get some ash and see if we could do something.
Gislason and some of his colleagues drove from Reykjavik to the foot of the volcano, collected some ash, and when planes started flying again, they sent the samples to Stipp in Denmark, where she analyzed them. One thing became clear at once.
They made exactly the right decision.
To close the airspace, that is. Stipp says her analysis shows there were several reasons the ash particles from the Iceland volcano were so dangerous. First, they were particularly fine-grained.
And those fine particles are extremely sharp compared to typical ash, which is usually somewhat more rounded.
They were also extremely hard.
And the sharpness and the hardness makes them abrasive for airplane wings and bodies and windows.
The abrasion can make it impossible to see out the cockpit window. Finally, the fact they were small posed a particular threat to jet engines.
If they're tiny particles, then they melt quickly, and then they condense on the cooler engine parts and cause them to fail.
Stipp's research appears in the current issue of the journal PNAS. Obviously, in this case, her research came after decisions about air travel had been made. But Stipp says this kind of analysis could help authorities make informed decisions the next time a plume of ash intersects a busy airline travel corridor. Joe Palca, NPR News.
This is NPR.